This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Ammon Bundy is on trial 9 months after leading an occupation of Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. One occupier was killed in that standoff over the federal government's right to own land, and the federal government owns a lot of it here in the West. Covering the federal trial in Portland is Oregon Public Broadcasting editor Ryan Haas. Ryan told me what Bundy said when he gave his first testimony in the case yesterday.
Well, rather than hearing about his time in Oregon, we heard a lot about Ammon Bundy's childhood and growing up on the Bundy Ranch in Nevada, and a lot of backstory and personal character about who he is and why he became involved in this federal lands movement.
Yes, Ammon Bundy talked a lot about that famous Nevada standoff with his father, Cliven Bundy, but why is that relevant to this trial?
Well, I think to Ammon Bundy and his attorneys, they want to show that he is a normal guy who never set out to challenge the federal government, that the federal government are the ones who came to Nevada and sort of changed who he is as a person. You know, they wanted to present him as a likable guy who is standing up for his family and for the rights of rural Americans in the West. So they talked a lot about how the events of Bunkerville changed who he is and compelled him to eventually come to Oregon.
And how is any of that a defense against the charge, which is impeding federal workers from doing their jobs?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's a question that the judge asked the defense attorneys. You know, she said yesterday, look, you guys can talk about Ammon's life and how that how the 2014 standoff in Bunkerville affected his mindset, but at the end of the day, that doesn't necessarily answer this conspiracy charge that you're facing. And so I think it's a strategic gamble on the defense's part to see if they can sway jury members to maybe end up as a hung jury or nullify the charges.
Can you tell what the jury is going to be asked to decide when it comes to the trial of these seven people accused of this occupation?
Well, when this trial goes to the jury stage, the judge is going to give them very clear directions. She's going to say, you know, this is how you're going to judge this piece of evidence, and this is how you're going to judge this piece of evidence. And at the end of the day, you're deciding whether these guys conspired to impede federal officers from doing their jobs. And it's not about land transfer movement, and it's not about feeling wronged by the federal government. It's about whether they decided to stop federal workers from doing their jobs.
But of course, Ryan, this emotional question of whether the federal government can own so much land, or I suppose any land, that has your listeners really, it sounds like, really involved in this case.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you're in the West and you understand that so much land out here is owned by the federal government. And, you know, there's a large number of people out here who feel like their livelihoods have been basically cut down. You know, we have the timber industry where a lot of people no longer can log federal land because of restrictions from the federal government. And so they feel like, hey, these guys are prohibiting us from just living our lives, so what can we do to change that? But at the end of the day, a lot of these questions that Ammon Bundy and people who support him are asking have already been settled by the courts.
So what is at stake in this case, do you think?
Well, I think what's at stake is whether these types of actions continue to happen, right? So if the federal government loses this case, it sort of sets a precedent that these types of actions, taking over federal buildings, taking over federal land in an effort to regain land, these types of actions are allowable. And it's the same for the defendants in this case, except for the inverse, right? So if they get heavy sentences and they go to jail for a long time, it kind of takes the wind out of the sails of this movement. And it may redirect some of these people into other means of protest, like appealing to legislatures to change laws and that sort of thing.
Finally, Ryan, this is, as we said, it's politically polarizing. It's emotional. A man died in this standoff. But the jury doesn't necessarily know or get instructed to care about all that stuff. What do you have any take on where you think this case is going?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think the jury is instructed not to pay attention to some of these things, but also at the end of the day, they're human people. And, you know, hearing that a man died at the hands of the federal government during this standoff is certainly going to be an emotional thing. And, you know, the federal government or the prosecutors brought in truckloads of guns during their closing statements. And, you know, that, of course, is going to have an impact on how the jury perceives what happened there. And so I think for what's going to happen going forward, I think, again, that really comes back to this question of whether the verdict in this case fuels or sort of tamps down this movement.
That is Ryan Haas with Oregon Public Broadcasting telling you about the federal trial in Portland of Ammon Bundy and six other people. Earlier this year, those armed occupiers took hold of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon. They're charged with conspiracy to impede federal workers from doing their jobs. Oregon Public Broadcasting is following Bundy's trial with a podcast called This Land is Our Land. You can get it wherever you download your podcasts. It's The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Now let's talk about your government and your privacy. You know, the ACLU's been spearheading a national effort to get police to ease up on their use of surveillance technology. Seattle police have adopted some of that technology. They've bought drones. They've installed surveillance cameras and put up a wireless network downtown that could track cell phones. Well, all that stopped after a public outcry. Then, last week, we found out Seattle police also bought software that can monitor your social media posts. From the ACLU of Washington, Shankar Narayan told KUOW's Kim Malcolm he's concerned about how these social media tools could be used.
These are systems that allow a deep dive into someone's social media presence. In other words, not only what they might post on, say, Facebook or Twitter or other social media websites, but also things they might post on chat rooms, for example. Even, for example, conversations that they might have thought were private, but because of some nuance of their privacy settings or a resetting of their privacy settings, something that these engines could pick up. And what you get then is the combination of all of these pieces of information to create a pretty clear picture of someone's associations, where they go, so their location on almost a real-time basis, whether they engage in protests, all of those kinds of things that we consider activity protected by the First Amendment. Law enforcement can now get a fairly clear picture based on these tools that are readily available. There are at least a dozen different software products, and the one that Seattle Police Department purchased is called Geofedia. So that's one example of something that hasn't been happening before that Seattle Police Department has acquired without that publicly transparent process.
What are your concerns about the use of these electronic surveillance tools?
I think at the most fundamental level, we're talking about preserving the relationship between community members and their government as being a relationship of freedom. What we've seen is where people feel that they're being surveilled, they act differently and they don't necessarily come out with their most original ideas. They may hesitate to go to their place of worship. They may hesitate to associate with people that rightly or wrongly the authorities may deem suspicious. There's many ways that are very subtle in which people will change their behavior if they feel that they're being surveilled. And because surveillance is becoming so much easier and cheaper, we really need to have the debate at the front end about whether we can still be a free society in the context of this kind of ubiquitous surveillance. So at its root, it's really about preserving all of our fundamental freedoms.
Now, I understand the ACLU is particularly concerned with communities of color and low-income communities, saying they've been turned into fishbowls, in essence. Why is that?
Well, we've seen historically that even the kinds of, you know, brick-and-mortar or analog surveillance, for want of a better word, in terms of who gets surveilled, who gets stopped, who gets arrested, and who gets sentenced. We have disproportionality at all points of our criminal justice system, even in the world we live in today. And I think that it's reasonable to expect that those kinds of disproportionalities would also apply in the kinds of technologies we're talking about. these technologies are really only as good as the data sets that go into them, the assumptions that are built into them by the people that are building them, and also the ways in which they're deployed. And there's more and more studies coming out that show that there's actually bias potentially in all three of those areas, which can result then in the disproportionate targeting of communities of color.
Seattle, as you know, has an ordinance on the books regarding police surveillance. In fact, the Seattle Police Department is required to get city council approval before they purchase surveillance equipment. To what extent is Seattle's law considered a national model?
It is considered a model for the nation, but at the same time, because this field moves so quickly, even though the law was enacted only 3 years ago, it's already in need of an update. The first is that the definition needs to be made crystal clear in terms of what it covers and doesn't cover. I think there's been an argument made that because social media monitoring systems are software and not perhaps equipment, as the ordinance states, that maybe they fall outside the purview of the ordinance, although we would argue otherwise. That needs to be clarified both for the sake of people in Seattle who want transparency, but also for the agencies that are trying to figure out how to go through this process and acquire technologies. The second thing that needs to happen is that the exigent circumstances loophole in the law needs to be gotten rid of. There's basically a provision that says that if there's an emergency, you can go ahead and deploy the technology without going through an ordinance process. Unfortunately, that's been misused to allow for things like ongoing two-year contracts for software or hardware that I think were never contemplated to be driven through that loophole in the first place.
There are some people in law enforcement who might argue that there are considerable benefits to using surveillance technology. It can help them solve crimes. It can increase public safety. So how do you respond to that?
I say by all means, let's have that conversation. I think it's often presented that there's this false dichotomy between public safety and your ability to retain privacy or be free from unnecessarily intrusive government surveillance. What we would like to see is a real debate about what's effective in protecting public safety, and then a balancing of the benefit of a particular technology in terms of public safety against the kinds of chilling effects, the diminishment of community trust, and all of the other impacts that that deployment may have. And I think if you apply that process, you get a much healthier community where you're really investing in technology that works to keep people safe. Unfortunately, I don't think that we've always followed that model consistently, but we certainly should, because we can be both safe and free.
Talking with KUOW's Kim Malcolm, that's Shankar Narayan, who directs technology and liberty efforts with the ACLU of Washington. The Seattle Police Department says it's not using Geofedia anymore, and a spokesperson told The Stranger that the software was used for criminal investigations and not as a surveillance tool to track people engaged in constitutionally protected activities. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. This is KUOW's Record with a story to tell you now. Native American actress Misty Upham had an impressive resume. She had appeared on screen with Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts. She was in the TV show Big Love and the movie Django Unchained. Upham also had a history of mental illness. And 2 years ago today, Upham went missing in Auburn, where she was living with her parents. 11 days later, a search party of family friends found her body in the woods near Misty's apartment. An investigation by the Guardian newspaper last year found the Auburn police didn't do much to help find her. Kristen Miarez Young wrote that piece for the Guardian, and she told Jeannie Yandel about the Auburn police's last interaction with Misty Upham. A deli worker called and said Upham was shoeless and hiding in the bushes outside the store. When the police arrived, they dragged Upham from the bushes, handcuffed her, and put her in the squad car.
And one of the officers said to her, "Well, if you're so famous, you know, if you're an actress, why don't you call up your friend Robin Williams and have him come save you?" And when the Auburn PD later characterized their interactions with Misty Upham, they said that they had acted with professionalism and compassion. And I think that this officer's own report from that evening, he admitted that he mocked her and her kind of lack of agency. I mean, once you're in the back of that patrol car, they're the only ones who can really let you out.
During this final interaction with the Auburn police, where she was handcuffed and put in the back of the car, she had a lot going on in her personal life. What was happening in Misty Upham's personal life at that time?
Well, she had moved to Washington State to kind of gather resources and to help her father in his recovery from a stroke. And they were living in her sister's small apartment. And she had always been one of the main financial supports for her parents. But I think that the hardest thing for her was that she had just suffered a miscarriage, and she had very much wanted to keep this son, and she was not able to. At the same time that she suffered that trauma, because she had moved from California to Washington and was accessing health care through the Indian Health Service, she needed to go through a process to reapply for her prescriptions for benzodiazepines, which she used to control her anxiety, which was rampant. And she also was suffering from depression, and she had PTSD as a result of a series of rapes in her childhood. And so she had been in Washington for months, and, you know, one by one, these prescriptions were running out. And so she, according to her friends and family, turned to alcohol to try to dull this constant anxiety and panic that she suffered. And I think about that, being in a very small apartment, suffering from panic attacks, being so far away from the culture that supported her acting. And I think the pressure of maintaining that became too much to bear.
Misty Upham went missing about 6 weeks later. She went missing on October 5th, 2014. She left the apartment very upset. What did the police do next at that point?
Her father went after her, but was not, you know, immediately behind her, but close enough. When he got down to the bottom of the stairs, the first thing the police said was like, hey, and they made him go back upstairs to search the apartment. They did not believe him that she was not there. And those were critical minutes. We know from the King County Medical Examiner's estimate that she died around 9 p.m., that same day in woods that are a very short walking distance. In fact, she and her father used to walk their dog by those woods all the time. But what we don't know is, where did she go immediately? When those police officers were with her father, was she already in the woods? We don't know that.
In the process of reporting this story for The Guardian, what did you learn about what the Auburn police did to try and find Misty Upham once she went missing?
What I found is that they did not invest the necessary time and resources to find or search for Misty. While they did conduct an investigation over a period of months, it was intermittent. And I know that had it been one of their daughters who had gone missing, they would have created a radically different response.
How do you know that?
If you look at other investigations that they were conducting, they used their Facebook page as a way to gather tips. They put information out there. They gave out updates. You know, they didn't even go to Facebook to distribute a photo of Misty. It would have taken them 5 seconds to put a photo of Misty online, but they never did. In fact, the only time that they began sharing on social media or via press release what was happening with Misty was when their constant pressure from the public and the media made it more efficient for them to do so rather than responding individually to the media requests. And when they first received those calls and emails, they said, no, we have no plans to even create a press release to confirm that Misty is missing and ask for tips leading to her appearance. That's minimum. That's a bare minimum to announce that a member of a community is missing and ask for tips.
Clearly this bothers you. Working on this story has gotten under your skin a little bit, it seems like, from what I'm observing. What is it that got under your skin about this?
Well, I think as a human being, I believe that each human life has value. And Misty Upham was treated like her life had no value. And that fundamental injustice rankled. It still rankles. But also, I think about this person who, against all odds, had accomplished tremendous things. She was a preeminent Native actress, and she was young still. And so that all of that grit and determination would be dismissed because she was a brown woman who occasionally acted erratically in front of the police. And knowing how much I and everyone rely on the police to keep us safe, it made me feel tremendously unsafe to know that care is so subjective. And on a more personal level, you know, she and I were pregnant at around the same time. And, you know, I was able to birth my son. And I think about the joy that he's brought me and what that kind of joy might have done for Misty during this difficult time in her life, whether it would have made the difference. And in the end, it's a combination of factors. We don't know what would have made the difference for her. But that she was not given that chance. She deserved better.
Kristen Miaras Young is a Seattle-based reporter and writer. Her story about the disappearance and death of Native American actor Misty Upham was published in The Guardian newspaper. We will tweet out a link to that story right now, at KUOW. Misty Upham disappeared from her family's house in Auburn 2 years ago today. More of KUOW's The Record just ahead. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The creepy clown story has finally made it to Seattle. This week, a clown was seen walking around Green Lake at dusk. People described it as covered in blood with a choking device around its neck. Yesterday, Seattle schools sent a warning to parents to keep an eye out. This is part of a string of clown sightings across the country, and it's creeping people out. So what is happening here, and how come clowns? Psychologist Rami Nader directs the North Shore Stress and Anxiety Clinic in North Vancouver, British Columbia. He studies the irrational fear of clowns. Yes, there is a clinical term for that, coulrophobia. Dr. Nader, welcome.
Yes, good afternoon.
We called you because, as you've heard, people dressed as clowns are popping up around the country, including Seattle now. What's your sense of what's going on?
Well, there's sort of two phenomena that I think are going on here. The first is the fear of clowns has been around for a while. That is nothing new. What's more interesting is that it's sort of taken on this life of people intentionally going out trying to scare people and trying to sort of creep people out by dressing up as clowns. And as you just described, you know, bloody clown with a chain around its neck, it's almost independent of the fear of clowns itself. If you had anybody dressed up like that, regardless of whether he was in a clown outfit or not, would probably be creeping people out and scaring people.
True. And we should say, we don't really know, is this a publicity stunt? Are these pranksters, do they really want to scare people? Are they actually violent? So there's a lot of wondering. But one of the things we wondered about is, as we said, coulrophobia. When I grew up, Doctor, Bozo the Clown and Emmett Kelly the Clown were national treasures. Why do so many people say clowns are creepy?
Well, research actually demonstrates about 12% of the population will say that people are uncomfortable with clowns. Not to say that they have a phobia of clowns, but that there's just a general discomfort with them. Part of it has to do with the clown. It's got this exaggerated emotional expression, sort of this big exaggerated smile that's always on. And there's sort of a discrepancy between what you see on the clown's face versus what the clown's actually feeling, because nobody can be happy all the time. And so,
especially a clown that just pulled a giant tooth out of its head, it can't possibly be feeling happy right now.
Exactly. And so you know that the clown is putting on a facade. And so there's a level of discomfort wondering, okay, what exactly is the clown feeling? What exactly is the clown thinking that you can't see in terms of the facial expression?
Yeah.
Also, clowns historically have been kind of the jesters and pranksters. And so if you're around a clown at a party, you kind of always have to be on guard. Otherwise, you might, you know, get the squirt of water in the face or the pie in the face. So there's always a tendency to be aware of clowns. And in more recent decades, you've seen media portrayals of clowns in a far more evil way. Stephen King's It, you know, all sorts of movies with sort of crazed or demonic clowns hurting or harming people. And so it's kind of given clowns a bad reputation.
I'm glad you brought up Stephen King. As you said, his bestseller, It, is known for its murderous clown. And today, Stephen King tweeted out, "Hey guys, time to cool the clown hysteria. Most of them are good. Cheer up the kiddies. Make people laugh." How do you wish people react when creepy clownitis breaks out?
Well, I think a similar sort of way. I mean, the clowns, vast majority of clowns are sort of normal, good, friendly, there to sort of cheer people up. I think most of the people who are doing the creepy clown thing right now aren't actually clowns. They're not. They're just people that are sort of jumping on a bandwagon of scaring people, and this is their venue and their avenue to do it.
Dr. Rami Nader, psychologist and director of the North Shore Stress and Anxiety Clinic in North Vancouver, BC, telling us about coulrophobia, the irrational fear of clowns, and how it's playing out lately with clown sightings across the country, including at Green Lake. Doctor, thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Come to think of it, Emmett Kelly was a sad clown, I suppose. And he finally, Dr. Nader, referred to this as a bandwagon thing. And it's true. If you have expressed that you find clowns creepy, we get it. Clowns can, looked at in a certain way, be sort of creepy. You're not the first. And so go away, clowns. Go back to where you came from. This is KOW's Week in Review. We're going to cover the vice presidential debate and political cartoons and news from Canada coming up. I've just been informed by our producer, Jason Pagano, that this is not technically the Week in Review. This is the last night in review right now because we're going to review the presidential debate between Tim Kaine and Mike Pence. The reviews were not so good, actually. We talked to Libby Watson, a staff writer at the nonpartisan Sunlight Foundation, and she said nobody won last night, including Americans.
There was a lot of back and forth and a lot of sort of bickering, but not a lot of real answers for the American people on, really what the candidates believe or, what Donald Trump has actually said in the past.
Well, that sounds exactly like part of the problem, Libby, is that these vice presidential candidates were talking about the presidential candidates. I've heard some people say, stop with the vice presidential debates. We haven't always done them and they're just no good.
Yeah, I've heard people say that too. And, it's, The question, in debates is what kind of a president or vice president would these people be? And I don't think we really got a whole lot of information about that. It was, Donald Trump was the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and, no one really learned a lot about anything. There was some discussion of policy, for sure. But I think, part of the problem is, we saw this with discussions about, debate moderators before the first debate, is that, this year moderators aren't really joining in with the fact-checking mid-debate. And, that's difficult when in this campaign, certainly it's not been easy for everyone to agree on what the facts are, we could say. But it's really difficult for voters to learn a lot if there isn't a moderator there, explaining to voters, no, actually this thing is true or this thing isn't true.
I also saw you say that what the past vice presidential debates had that this was missing was Joe Biden.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of people felt that. And, it's not necessarily specifically about Joe Biden, but, it was certainly missing some of the panache that the 2012 debate had, let's say. It wasn't a barn burner. It wasn't necessarily entertaining. And that's not necessarily what a debate should be if we're talking about, our democracy. It's not necessarily that an entertaining debate is a good debate, but I don't think it was particularly memorable, and the 2012 debate was pretty memorable.
Somehow the standard has become, who do you want to have a beer with? It sounds like you don't want to quaff a pint with either one.
No, not interested in a pint with either. It's the debate format is I don't think particularly conducive to discovering who you actually want to have a beer with. And I think actually, that can lead to a worse debate if candidates are just trying to, get in their zingers and, have the best lines. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're actually learning a ton about what their positions are or what their opponent's positions are. But certainly if that was the standard I don't think anyone is particularly raring to shake either of their hands.
How do you compare these debates with what happens in your native England?
That's an interesting question. I mean, we only started having debates recently. You know, the first prime ministerial candidate debates were in 2010, and they have clearly borrowed heavily from the American format. You know, I've been interested in America for a long time, and, you know, I had seen the 2008 debates before that, and it was kind of funny to see British people trying to do that, because we're just not, you know, we're just not as loud as Americans. We don't normally do things like, you know, like these sort of news production events. But, you know, we had them in 2015 again. And, you know, I will say one of the things that I think, you know, America really needs is a moderator like Jeremy Paxman in the UK. You know, we have very strong adversarial media. And I think that was a great debate, because Paxman was grilling them on what they actually, you know, would do, or, you know, what they believe. There isn't much room for that in these debates. There isn't much room for grilling from the moderators in the U.S. debates.
Interesting. So the English are not as loud as Americans, except for the moderators.
I mean, obviously, I will say, you know, we have Parliament. Parliament is mostly shouting at each other, but, you know, that's kind of our theater. But the sort of, you know, these debates, like I said, they're kind of news productions. You know, they're sort of cable news explosions. But, yeah, I mean, in 2015, there were a couple of debates, and there was one that was just, you know, the moderator going after the candidate's positions. And I feel like that's something that could be imported here.
Libby, you're a staff writer at this nonpartisan Sunlight Foundation. So will you, in a nutshell, tell me what the Sunlight Foundation's interest is? And then I want to know what then was your particular interest in last night's debate?
Sure. So we're a transparency organization, and we advocate for transparency in the government. So we were definitely interested in, you know, whether Donald Trump's tax returns would be mentioned. We've been advocating for Donald Trump to release his tax returns. So we were pleased to see that that was brought up, although, you know, like I said, there haven't really been many conclusions. You know, we didn't really learn a lot about Donald Trump's taxes. Again, you know, we were pleased to see discussion of the Clinton Foundation and of the Trump Foundation. Those are, you know, two important issues for us, you know, the use of these foundations, you know, potentially for political favors is very important for the public to know about.
From the Sunlight Foundation, that is staff writer Libby Watson. The vice presidential candidates both talked passionately last night about abortion rights and religion, and we're going to look more closely at that aspect of this campaign later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Now, if you were to draw a political cartoon of last night's vice presidential debate, how would you do that? That's not an easy thing to do, to capture all the complexity of a political event or issue in a single drawing. Our next guest appreciates the craft of political cartooning so much, she and her team put together exhibits every 4 years showcasing presidential election cartoons. University of Washington librarian Jessica Albano told me why she finds cartoons so powerful.
Within one single frame, a cartoonist is able to depict the issues that are happening and being discussed, the events that have occurred. It just takes a few brushstrokes and a few words, and you immediately get their biting criticism over what's happening in the world today.
Yeah, it can be hard to read a whole editorial, much less news coverage.
It takes a long time to read an editorial and really think about it, because they are complicated issues that people are describing. And so the cartoons to us are similar to watching like Samantha Bee Show or Stephen Colbert or The Daily Show. Those clips are so easily accessible, and you watch a few minutes and you get the point immediately. And cartoons are the same way. And we find them just as appealing to UW students as those sorts of videos that they're watching online to get their news.
It's such a tricky word, cartoons. To those who think silly, political cartoons are just such a craft.
Oh, definitely. I'm in awe. It's an art.
You've been watching political cartoons since around September 11, 2001?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. We get a lot of newspapers from around the world in our library collection, in Suslo Library. And right after 9/11, they started coming in. And they showed such poignant signs of empathy and sympathy towards what we were going through, lots of tears on their national symbols in the cartoons. And so we wanted to show that on the display boards. And then we saw them changing. The focus of the cartoon started changing as we marched closer to war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they started showing more fear and eventually hostility towards the United States over our actions and what we were doing. And it was just so wonderful to show that graphically that in 2004, we were looking for an excuse to do another cartoon exhibit. And so we've done it for every presidential election since then.
You've brought with you a few favorites from this election season. Will you narrate a few?
Sure, of course. One that recently came out in August is from the Houston Chronicle by Nick Anderson. And it shows a woman with media written on her back of her dress. And she's pushing a baby carriage with a baby Donald Trump in there. And there's a gentleman passing by and baby Trump says, "She's trying to destroy me." And the gentleman says, "Didn't she create you?" Which is just such a wonderful thing, because it's been amazing to watch Donald Trump get so much media attention and kind of take the oxygen out of the room, it seems like. I mean, he's dominating the cartoon landscape just like he's dominating the media airwaves from what we've seen. So I love this cartoon and how now he's mad that the media have kind of turned on him and they're starting to hold him accountable for what he's saying.
And what hits you right away in this cartoon is the caricature of Donald Trump as this orange-faced baby, which is a feature of this season. How do you caricature Donald Trump as a cartoonist?
Oh, they're doing it in lots of different ways. There's a lot of fun with his hair. It's usually crazy and flying away in the wind.
But isn't it so crazy that it's hard to caricature?
Well,
I mean, just Donald Trump in general. Do you find cartoonists struggling with that or making hay, having a great time?
I think they're having a great time. I can't speak for them, but it looks like they're having a great time. They're having a great time with his physical appearance. I mean, his hands are tiny. He has a big old belly in a lot of them. And a lot of them just kind of creep us out or like gross. I mean, there's been a lot of play with the Olympics and showing him as a diver and saying, if I don't win this race, the race is rigged, and, you know, plays on that. And I don't want to see Trump in a swim trunks, to be honest.
I'm sorry you had to see that.
Yeah, well, I am too. Yeah.
What's another cartoon for this
Okay,
season?
Well, one about Hillary, because we really try to be fair and balanced in our displays. So there's one from the Arizona Republic from Steve Benson, and it's titled Hillary Rising. And it shows Hillary as a cross between a donkey and Pinocchio. And her nose is growing, but it's not growing straight out like Pinocchio's nose. It looks like a graph on an opinion poll. And it says, Americans think she's lying. And that's what a lot of the cartoons about Hillary have been about, her lying or her billionaire dollars that she's bringing in and her email scandal.
And how are cartoonists physically capturing Hillary?
Well, she's often likened to this donkey Pinocchio character, but she's also shown as just a small frumpy woman in frumpy pantsuits. She doesn't garner the same reaction or kind of the uncomfortable reaction in me that the Donald Trump cartoons get. Yeah. It's mostly her words and how they're accusing her of what she's doing that I find powerful.
You're not just collecting election-related cartoons. You're picking up on lots of current events, the police violence, for example. Tell us about that.
Our primary focus is the presidential election, but it's impossible to ignore the events as they unfold. So the first event we started putting up when we started back in mid-June was the shootings at the nightclub in Orlando. And sometimes these things make their way into the political conversation and sometimes they don't. But we have one poster that we titled The Summer of 2016. And because it just has that vibe with the summer of 68. And so we're highlighting Black Lives Matter and the police shootings. And some of those are the most impactful because you expect a cartoon to be funny and happy, but biting. But these are just sad and heartbreaking.
What's one of those cartoons?
So this one is from the Miami Herald, Jim Morin from July 8th. And the title is We Had Better Overcome. And it's a white policeman and a black man. And the policeman is holding his hat in his hand and they're arm in arm. And the black man has a Black Lives Matter T-shirt on and they're both shedding a tear. And so the only words are we had better overcome. But it says so much. It's like we need to address this and overcome this or we're really going to hurt in the future.
That poignancy and that, in a way, simplicity, together, apart, it just is perfect for a political cartoon.
Definitely.
Jessica, you and I have been bonding over how much we both love editorial cartoons, and I have since I was a child. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why do these cartoons matter so much?
I think they matter because they represent our history and what we're experiencing today in a graphical, powerful, biting way. And something about graphics or visual, even though it's a still image, still resonates so deeply. And it's just an amazing art form that with just such few words, they can say so much. And they either appeal to us because we really agree with them, or we might really disagree, and then it makes us really angry. But either way, we want to show them to our friends.
That's University of Washington librarian Jessica Albano, a collector of political cartoons. And if you want to see the collection she's got going, go to the Susilo Library on the UW campus in Seattle. We are right in the middle of campaign season, and Susilo is hopping with cartoons from all over the country, and they're adding new ones every day. Jessica Albano hopes this exhibit's going to spark some conversation and even encourage Husky students to vote. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Now we turn to rats. Why are there so many in Seattle? Do we have extra rats? I'm asking because a KUOW listener's asking. It's part of our Local Wonder reporting project where you tell KUOW what you're curious about and we get you answers. Susan Roxborough of the Green Lake neighborhood, hello.
Hi there.
Your question to us was about Seattle rats and what got you wondering?
Well, I lived in Seattle. Well, before I lived in Seattle, I lived in New York for several years. And so I was quite used to seeing rats scurrying along subway tracks and occasionally in Riverside Park. Mm-hmm. But that was the extent of it. And I'm actually from Toronto, which is a really large, sprawling urban city. And I never saw rats in Toronto, even though the city sits on the edge of Lake Ontario. But when I moved to Seattle and bought a house in Green Lake, I started seeing regularly what I thought were squirrels running along at the top of the fence in my backyard at night.
Hmm.
But then I realized, of course, squirrels sleep at night, and when I got a little closer, I realized they were rats. And then later in a different house, I found that we had rats in our detached garage. And so the more I started talking to people about my rat problems, the more stories I started hearing about other people having rats in their garages or in attics or in bushes or seeing them run along the tops of the, you know, wires in neighborhoods. So I've long wondered whether or not Seattle has a disproportionate number of rats, and if so, why that might be, and that's what prompted my local wonder question.
Yeah, if you're just talking to your neighbors, it could be a very localized problem. But if only there were a radio station that could widen this out and help you, Susan. We hope to do that.
I hope so, too. I'm curious. I'll be curious to know the answer.
Thanks a lot. Susan Roxborough in Green Lake. In fact, I saw our reporter, Ashley Ahern, is on this. She was in an alley late last night, apparently, getting Susan some answers. So we will report back to Susan soon. I want to ask our web producer, Kara McDermott. Kara, you see the traffic in social media. Is Susan expressing a common feeling that Seattle's got a rat problem?
Oh, yeah. If you were to judge solely by the comments on our Facebook page right now, you'd think the city was drowning in rats.
Oh.
They're seeing them, just like Susan, on power lines, hearing them in walls, finding them in clawfoot tubs. One person wrote, a house near Gasworks Park was Bolo's, and you should have seen the rats run out of it.
Hmm.
Jess said that she had one come out of her toilet, and it was horrifying.
Indeed.
But I think the most troubling one is actually a story from Maya, who said, walking to work one morning, and a rat walked by me on the sidewalk, going the other direction like he was headed to the office. He didn't even glance my way for a second.
That is when it's bad, when at least the rats should scurry. But when they're not even afraid of you, they're just striding office like, that's trouble. Kara, thank you. So help our listener out, will you? What is your craziest rat encounter in Seattle. What is your experience with Seattle and rodents? Let us know, 206-221-3663. Again, 221-3663. You can write to us. It's record@kuow.org. And, of course, comment on our Facebook page, and we will set our local wonder reporter, Ashley Ahern, scurrying for an answer. This is The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Now, the Seattle Times recently quoted a Chinese real estate site saying that Seattle saw more inquiries from mainland Chinese home buyers than did any other American city in 4 out of the last 7 months. And why? One reason might be a new tax in Vancouver, British Columbia. From the Vancouver Sun, always good to talk with columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi, Bill. I wondered where those dollars were going to go. They took off from British Columbia like a flock of spooked birds and disappeared when we brought in that tax. Some indication they went to Toronto, but it looks to me like they're circling the skies over Seattle as well.
Right. Will you remind us of this foreign buyer tax?
Yeah, so British Columbia has been under pressure for a long time to do something about a perceived, increasingly documented influx of buyers from China buying up residential property in British Columbia. So government brought in a special tax over the summer, which kicked in first week of August, a 15% tax on foreign buyers buying residential property in Metro Vancouver. It had an immediate effect, dramatic. One day, the day before the tax kicked in, the government recorded $900 million worth of transactions, residential real estate bought by foreign buyers, mostly from China, in and around Vancouver. Over the next month, that dropped to $17 million, so almost 90% reduction in sales. The buyers were driven out of the BC market. We weren't 100% sure what the effect was going to be, whether they just sit on their wallets or go somewhere else. Real estate prices in Toronto were still climbing. Clearly, some of them went there. I was fascinated to see the story you just mentioned, Bill. The Seattle Times indicating a massive increase in interest in real estate market in Seattle.
How popular is the tax in Metro Vancouver?
It's done wonders for the provincial government. The public reaction was a big jump in the government's approval rating. A lot of grumbling from realtors, grumbling from people that were in the middle of a sales transaction who couldn't close the deal. But the reaction publicly has been entirely favorable. I think the government's asking itself why it didn't do this sooner. There's been a bunch of other changes in the market as well, some evidence that the market had kind of peaked. But no, it's been a popular tax. As I said, some grumbling from special interests, but nothing from the public.
That's interesting because, yes, there are realtors, there are special interests, but there are plenty of landowners who you might think are happy to see their property values go up, 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 but we might remind listeners who know that Seattle real estate has gotten more expensive that we are not at Vancouver levels.
That's true, you're not. And look, it's always going to be a trade-off. If you own your property outright, the more people competing to buy it, the better. But I think there was a growing awareness in British Columbia that it was very, very hard on renters, on students, on people on fixed incomes, on young families trying to buy their way into the market. All of that was being impacted. And I think a lot of people already knew their property had appreciated. They'd already seen some of the benefit for that. It was time to slow the express train down and just rein things in. As long as it doesn't collapse into a complete mortgage bubble and you end up with a bunch of people with properties underwater, and we haven't had that happen yet, I think this will stand as having been probably a long overdue move for the government and one that's generally popular with the public.
And, of course, people are asking here in the Seattle area, tax on foreign buyers, should we do that? And I have checked locally in Seattle and King County, and they do not have the authority here to impose that kind of localized tax. And the state of Washington has shown no interest in such a thing, at least so far. And finally, Vaughn, I wanted to ask you about a Monday holiday coming up, and I'm not talking about Columbus Day. Are you going to observe Thanksgiving?
Canadian Thanksgiving. Yes, we do it earlier in Canada, the theory being that it would be a good idea to have Thanksgiving while there was still something to harvest, since by the end of November, most of the country is in the deep freeze of winter. So we do have Canadian Thanksgiving, and I would dispute the recent story in the New York Times that there are no inherently Canadian dishes on Thanksgiving. I give you Thanksgiving Day poutine.
Poutine.
French fries, stuffing, cheese curds, turkey, and gravy. If that doesn't sound like a heart attack in a bowl, I don't know what does.
That's right. There was this New York Times story saying, sort of suggesting that Canada couldn't think of anything better to do, and so you just have pumpkin pie and roast turkey. Granted, you have a much better date than we do. It's ridiculous that we have it so close to the end of harvest. But okay, I like that. You're saying Canadians are perfectly capable of poutine, as you say.
Yes, Thanksgiving poutine. The other thing, of course, is the other reason it's not such a big deal here is because it doesn't trigger the Christmas shopping season. You don't get immediately into big sales and all that stuff, and you got a pretty good chance of getting home too, because the airplanes and the trains won't be held up by snow and ice, so you can actually enjoy time with your family. And here on the West Coast, of course, we still got pretty nice weather right now.
All more reasons to move to Canada, Vaughn. And I'm going to have to hold off on poutine until I taste it, but you've whet my appetite.
In the United States, you can celebrate both Thanksgivings. You can have Thanksgiving dinner in October as a Canadian, and again at the end of November with your friends and families because you lived in the United States, which qualifies you to celebrate two Thanksgivings.
And then the health club membership that follows. Vancouver Sun columnist, yes indeed. Vaughn Palmer, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And you've been listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. You can pull down a podcast of this show and the Week in Review and Radioactive and Speakers Forum and all that good stuff wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.